Judges chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. Now Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, Jerubbaal is Gideon's other name, you might remember. Now Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem, to his mother's kinsfolk, and said to them, and to the whole clan of his mother's family, say in the hearing of all the lords of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 sons of Jerubbaal, Gideon, rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. So his mother's kinsfolk spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the lords of Shechem. And their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he's our brother. They gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the temple of Baal-Berit, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. He went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, the sons of Gideon, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, survived, for he hid himself. Then all the lords of Shechem and all Bet Milo came together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. When it was told to Jotham, he went and stood at the top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, listen to me, you lords of Shechem, so that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint a king over themselves. So they said to the olive tree, reign over us. The olive tree answered them, shall I stop producing my rich oil by which gods and mortals are honored and go to sway over the trees? Then the tree said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree answered them, shall I stop producing my sweetness and my delicious fruit and go to sway over the trees? Then the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I stop producing my wine that cheers gods and mortals and go to sway over the trees? So all the trees said to the bramble, the thorn bushes, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in good faith you're anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now, therefore, if you acted in good faith and honor when you made Abimelech king, and if you've dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as his actions deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and rescued you from the hand of Midian, but you've risen up against my father's house this day, have killed his son, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his slave woman, king over the lords of Shechem because he's your kinsman. If I say you've acted in good faith and honor with Jerubbaal, with Gideon, and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech, and devour the lords of Shechem, and Beit Milo, and let fire come out from the lords of Shechem, and from Beit Milo, and devour Abimelech. Then Jotham ran away and fled, going to Be'er, where he remained for fear of his brother Abimelech. Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years, but God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the lords of Shechem, and the lords of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. This happened so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal of Gideon might be avenged, and their blood be laid on their brother Abimelech, who killed them, and on the lords of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. So out of hostility to him, the lords of Shechem sent ambushes on the mountaintops. They robbed all who passed by them along that way, and it was reported to Abimelech. What happens next is that these ambushes that are happening, Abimelech doesn't like it because he hasn't authorized that, and he's the king of these people, and they're doing things without his permission. So he hears word of that. In the meantime, another man shows up on the story we know nothing about. His name is Gaal, and he comes and begins to trash talk Abimelech. And Abimelech had some men in that bar that night when he was talking, because they were drinking and he was near drunk. And they went and reported to Abimelech, they're trash-talking you over there in Shechem. Those lords are disrespecting you. They got some new guy there who says he could take you out. And Abimelech says, oh, really? And he gathers up his army of men and he goes after him. Gaal comes out, and Abimelech sends his little his attaché, the guy who goes in front of him, and he says to them, hey, Gaal, Abimelech's here. The guy you said was a weak little wimp, so if you want to come out, we can see who can win. And Gaal says, sure, and he rallies some troops, and they come out. Abimelech wipes the carpet with him, finishes him off, and he goes running, barely any sword swung, and he goes running. But Abimelech isn't done. He's so upset about these betrayals that after he chases Gaal out, he goes after Shechem, which is where his mother lives. It's his hometown, and he destroys it. And then he salts the earth around it, which is a way of saying he makes it unlivable. But he's still not done. After he does that, he goes to a neighboring town. He's going to conquer the whole area. Everybody's betrayed him. So he goes to this neighboring town, and he's going to wipe them out too. And they have a tower in that town. Everybody runs into it to escape him. And he, as braggart that he is, walks up to the tower, and he's doing his thing, trying to take it down. I don't know if he's setting it on fire. But a woman just throws a stone out of a window, kills him. That's the end of Abimelech. Well, I've been thinking about the Abimelech story this week. What I want to look at today is the influence that Gideon had on his son Abimelech. The way in which Abimelech was mentored by Gideon had great influence over the way Abimelech took control of Israel, ruled Israel, and how his life ended. Each of us has an influence over the way another person imagines goodness. In fact, ethics, and when we talk about ethics, what we mean are the rules and principles by which we try to live with other people. But ethics really is more about imagination than memorization. If our children can understand what kind of a world the Ten Commandments imagines, they'll be better off than simply knowing what the Ten Commandments say. Ethics is more about imagination than it is memorization. And so for those of us, and we're going to get into Gideon and what he did for his kids, for those of us who are operating in the world, one of the tasks God has given us is to live in such a way that the world can imagine other ways of doing things. This is ethics. It's parenting. It's mentoring. It's being Christians in the world. In many ways, Gideon's example went before Abimelech. And this is, it's just a dastardly truth. But we can never control what other people do with the example we set. We can never control it. But we are still responsible for the example we set and whether or not we allow people to imagine a Christ-like way of living in this world or not. In many ways, Abimelech proved to be a fairly good imitator of his father. Most of what Abimelech does comes right out of the story of Gideon, and that's really why this sermon is the last in Gideon's story, even though Gideon is dead. Now, we've been talking a lot in previous weeks, for those who have been here, about some concerns about Gideon's character. He's a good man in some ways. He has a robust faith in God. He's able to take 300 men and conquer an army of 120,000 just believing that God would do it. That is a serious amount of faith, and that's praised not just in the book of Judges, but even in the New Testament book of Hebrews, where Gideon is praised for his faith. But we've had concerns about Gideon. He's going through the nation of Israel chasing the Midianites, and a couple of towns don't want to give him food. And boy, he comes back and he wreaks vengeance on those Israelite towns after he's done his campaign. He comes back and kills their leaders. Is that God's will? He conquered the kings of the Midianites and he kills them because he doesn't like the way they treated his family. Is that right? Is vengeance the right way to finish that battle? Gideon, at the end of his life, refuses to be king, but he sets up this golden ephod, either a priestly garment or a really expensive pair of underwear, and then he puts them in his house, and Israel starts to worship it, and he just lets it go. So we've had some questions about this guy. I mean, he's got a lot of faith, but he also makes some really questionable decisions. And what we have to recognize is that what Gideon did in his life and why he did it were influential forces that powerfully shaped his son's character and informed his son's decisions. And it is equally true of us that what we do and why we do it will also shape the lives of the people around us. The more impressionable, which is why we focus on children, the more they're shaped by it. But everyone's shaped by it. So we're going to ask this morning, what did Gideon teach his son? And then allow that to be a window into the question, what are we teaching our own children, the other people in our own lives, our own employees, or the people that we manage, or our own grandchildren, or our neighbors? The story of Gideon, and then we're going to get into the teachings of Jesus a little bit, and we're going to get into the teachings of Paul. And there are two primary areas that God has asked those who have influence to focus on. Just two. dominance and disloyalty. How do you exercise power, and how do you treat those who are disloyal to you? You'll find, though, that those two areas spill over into a lot of other areas. But it's those two that this story puts our eyes firmly on, and you'll find the teachings of Jesus and Paul in the New Testament also fix us here. So we're going to ask, what did Gideon teach his son about dominance, about how to lead, about how to exercise control or power? And secondly, how did he teach him to respond to disloyalty? And then we're going to ask the question, and this is personal, you can only answer it. How are you teaching the next generation about dominance and disloyalty? We're going to start with dominance. This comes from chapter 9, verses 1 to 6. But it's probably clear enough. I'll just read verse 5. He went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, survived, for he hid himself. Now Gideon, consistently throughout his life, had taught his children that dominance and power came through intimidation and violence. That was the story of Gideon. Make them afraid of you. Make them fear you. And then they'll follow. Right? That's Gideon. We see that in his life. And it's not his fault in some ways. That's the story he had been told. That's been the story all the way through Judges. It's the story of the Canaanite people long before Israel ever went into that land. In some ways, it's the story of all of human history. So Gideon just doesn't criticize it. He doesn't object to it. He just lives into it. But he taught his children that dominance came through intimidation and violence. Now, of course, we don't know if Gideon ever actually sat down with Abimelech and had the lecture with him. You know, Abimelech, no one's going to respect you unless you threaten them and then follow through with your threats. We don't know if he ever actually said that. The story never tells us that he did. In fact, Abimelech is a son of Gideon's concubine, and that's a legitimate wife. But Abimelech, because he was the son of a concubine, that's a lesser marriage. He could not have inherited. Even if his father was king, he would have no right to the throne. So he's sort of outside. The other 70 sons probably had more direct line of sight to Gideon. But Abimelech somehow, even though he's kind of on the outside of the family, he watches his father and he learns by his behavior what needs to happen. Now, we have to be careful, because Gideon's command to attack the Midianites came from God. And so he was acting on God's behalf. And at first, Gideon didn't want to go, but he does follow. But Abimelech, just watching his father's behavior, had to interpret what his father's values were based on what he was doing. And Abimelech seems to have learned the lessons that he put into practice in his life. And so what I want to say is that children, mentees, other people learn how to settle disputes by watching those they respect in conflict. We do understand in the church that God tells us that we're born with an inclination towards destructive behavior. That doesn't have to be taught or caught. It's there. But it can be nurtured or discouraged. And that's, of course, the job of parenting. So we need adults. Children need adults to help them imagine a different way. Children learn behaviors from adults. If we're to have a more peaceful world, it starts with the way adults act around children. I think that's powerful. Now, I've said this before, I'll keep saying it. We're not fully responsible for the things that people do with the example that we set. People have free will. God tells us in Ezekiel 18 that the soul who sins is the one who will die. But we do contribute to the worldview of those we raise and mentor, even those we encounter, by trying to give them a way to imagine behavior in whatever circumstance we find ourselves in. Gideon taught his children by example that leadership and power came by violence and intimidation and domination. But Jesus taught us another way, which he modeled for us, hence expanding our imagination if we watch him do it. And he explained it this way. This is in Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 30. A dispute also arose among them as to which one of them was to be regarded as the greatest. These are the disciples, Jesus' 12 inner circle, who'd spent most of the time with him and that he taught and specially commissioned. A dispute also arose among them as to which one of them was to be regarded as the greatest. But Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles, of the non-Jewish nations, lord it over them. And those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who's at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you, just as my Father has conferred on me, a kingdom, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So Jesus tries to expand their imagination by saying, you're right that I'm giving you a kingdom. You're right that I'm going to make you judges. You're right that I'm going to make you leaders. But the question, who's the greatest, means you haven't gotten at all what I'm all about. We're looking for folks who would more willingly sacrifice themselves and see another sacrificed on the altar of their success. That's what it looks like. He's trying to help you imagine a different way forward. When you're accused by someone falsely, you can read the story of Jesus before Pilate. When people ask you to pay taxes, you can read the story where Jesus is stopped at the gate and they say, you owe a tax. When you want to know what it means to raise children and respond to them, you can see the story where the disciples think the children aren't worth Jesus' time and they try to keep them away and he gives them a teaching moment about kids. Jesus shows us what it looks like to be a godly leader. He expands our imagination, but if our children are going to understand what it looks like to be a godly person in this time, in this age, then what you and I have learned from Jesus must become true in our lives. We must set the example so that they can imagine a different way of living. Otherwise, they're going to do what comes natural, which is sticks and stones and the breaking of bones. What does it mean to have dominion? What does it mean to exercise power? Gideon modeled terror, intimidation, bullying, and violence. What does it mean to have dominion? And the second major line of sight for this passage is, how should we respond to disloyalty? Look at verse 23 of chapter 9. But God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the lords of Shechem, and the lords of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. This happened so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might be avenged, and their blood be laid on their brother Abimelech, who killed them, and on the lords of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. He goes on to tell us that the Shechemites start to erode Abimelech's authority, and Abimelech starts to feel slighted by them, and then the whole rest of the story goes, which I explained. Now, we remember how Gideon responded to disloyalty. When people disrespected him, when they didn't treat him as he thought he should be treated, when he went to the cities of Succoth and Penuel, starving, chasing the Midianites, fighting for them, and they said, well, we'll feed you once we're sure you're going to win, but we don't know if you're going to win this battle, and we want to be seen as siding with the enemy, so we'll wait to see how it works out, and then if you win, come back, we'll take care of you. He did not like that. That was treason in his minds, and we remember what he did. He went back to those cities immediately after defeating the Midianites, and he killed all their leaders in gruesome ways. We also recall how Gideon dealt with the enemy kings who had killed members of his family. He conquered the two of them, Zebah and Zalmunna, and then he brought them to a place of execution, and he said, I'm going to have my son, this child, who did not take part in the battle. The scriptures tell us he was still a young boy. I'm going to have him kill you. However long it takes, however torturous, he's going to kill you because of what you did. Thankfully, Jether said no, spared them some gruesomeness. But it's what Gideon wanted. We know how Gideon responded to those who disrespected him. He took vengeance. Abimelech learned the importance of honor and the art of revenge from his father. And it led him to destroy not only the man who questioned his authority, not only the lords who supported that man, but his own hometown, his own mother's house. And then he couldn't stop. He wanted to destroy the whole region. And that bloodlust led to his own death. How are we helping our children to imagine defeating conflict? How do we teach them to respond to those who disrespect us, who are disloyal to us, who treat us beneath what we believe we deserve to be treated? Now again, we're not fully responsible for what people do with the example that we set for them, but we do contribute to the ethical imagination of the world in the ways we respond to harms. Gideon taught his children by example to defend personal honor by seeking vengeance against those who are disloyal. Again, Jesus taught us another way. This comes from Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 48. It's in Jesus' teaching, often called the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says this, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Let's just stop there. What's he talking about? He's saying, you've heard it said that if somebody hurts you, you should hurt them back. You shouldn't do worse, but you should do the same. That one bad turn deserves another. That one good turn deserves another. You've heard that if someone pokes you in your eye, you have a right to poke them in theirs. You've heard that if someone smashes up your car, you can key theirs. That's what Jesus is saying. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, imagine something different. Imagine if you didn't do that. Imagine if someone poked you in the eye and you didn't do that. And then what's the response? Well, what should I do then, Jesus? And if I don't poke him in the eye, he's going to poke me in the other eye. How do I protect myself? I got to lay a line down. I got to say, that's too far, buddy. I got to make him afraid of the consequences of hurting me. How else am I going to control his behavior? How else am I going to make myself safe? And so Jesus continues. I say to you, don't resist an evildoer. What? Did you have the imagination for that? Don't resist an evildoer, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. Jesus is taking things that happened in his world and he's applying the principle of not resisting an evildoer to it. So in his world, a Roman soldier could walk up to anybody they wanted and said, carry my gear for a mile. But they couldn't ask for more than a mile. That was a law so that people wouldn't be unduly oppressed. So that's something that could happen. So Jesus is giving an example. So a soldier asks you to take all of his gear for a mile. That's the limit of the law. Go 2. Someone could sue you for your outer garments, but they were not allowed to sue you for your inner garments. The principle of those laws is simply that you can't leave someone destitute, naked, and homeless through a lawsuit. So Jesus says to him, well, if they take your outer garments, give them it all. If someone strikes you on the one cheek, turn to him the other also. There was a way, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm going to go with it because it's what the commentary seemed to think, that there was a respectful way of slapping and a disrespectful way of slapping. And so if someone slaps you respectfully, give him the other cheek so he can slap you disrespectfully. Jesus is trying to apply a principle to his time and his day. What we need today is people to help our people in our culture imagine what it means not to resist an evildoer. Jesus goes on to say, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Just hear it the way he means it. You've heard that it was said, you should trust your neighbor and distrust your enemy. That you should choose the ones who love you and reject the ones who don't. That's what you've heard. You've heard it was said, you should love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends blessings on both. And he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. He sends curses or blessings on both equally. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect. The Greek is be complete, therefore, as your heavenly Father is complete. What kind of a world are we helping the people in our lives to imagine? How do they imagine leadership when they look at our example? How do they imagine responses to disrespect, disloyalty when they look at our example? Our children are the most impressionable, so they're the most likely to live into the future you're imagining for them. But everybody is influenced. We need to help our children, our grandchildren, the people in our lives, imagine the way of Jesus. And don't think you have to be perfect in every way, because when you fail, all you have to do, and I think this would have helped Gideon a lot, is explain your failure. What are we doing to help the people in our lives imagine the way of Jesus? Romans chapter 12, verse 9, where Paul brings together all these teachings under one roof. He says, let love be genuine. hate what is evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with mutual affection, outdo one another in showing honor. So here he's saying, if you want to compete, compete to show honor to other people. See how respectful you can be. That's our competition. How respectful can you be? That's what Paul says. Outdo one another in showing honor. Don't lag in zeal. Be ardent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering. Persevere in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Extend hospitality to strangers. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty. Don't be arrogant, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it's possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. No, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink, for by doing this you will heap burning coals on their heads. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Jesus suggests that in the place of dominance, we need to imagine a world of service. That in place of vengeance when people are disloyal to us, we need to imagine a world in which there's forgiveness and mercy. Ethics is an act of imagination. You and I help a better world to be imagined. What world are you helping those around you to imagine?